This is an Enterprise Times podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here with Rick McElroy of Carbon Black.
Rick McElroy, head of security strategy for Carbon Black. I've been doing security for the last 20 years since leaving the Marine Corps, and I get to fly all over the world, meet with very interesting people, and hopefully work on maturing their endpoint security strategy.
You've just released your second global threat report. What were the big things that came out for you?
I think there was a couple of things. One, I always like trends, so it's good to do a follow-up and not just do a point-in-time survey. I think the ones that were pretty alarming to me, 100% of government and local authority organizations have been breached. That's a crazy number. 88% of companies surveyed said they suffered a security breach in the past 12 months. That's starting to get to the alarming point for me when I start to look at that. Pulling those threads a little bit, what you see is like a quarter of the organizations that were breached have been breached multiple times. And it's not just that they've been breached multiple times, but they're now saying it's five times. In our last survey, it was three. So we've seen an increase in multiple breaches. And I think that's probably confirmed by meeting with our IR partners and our IR summit. When we talked to them my last trip over, what you heard clearly is we go into the same company two, three, four times, make recommendations for the company to improve their prevention and detection, and nothing happens. So for me, it's like I understand companies who have their heads buried in the sand and don't think they have an issue. I understand that a little more than companies who have been beat up and don't learn self-defense.
When they talk about it being breached multiple times, is this very different attacks? Is this because when they were breached the first time, they didn't really repair? Or is this the continual problem with a lack of training of insiders where people are just clicking on links and the software they have to detect it isn't good enough?
I think it's a blend of all of those things. In some cases, this rise in sophistication from the attackers. You see these very complex chains that leverage their supply chain. Watering hole attacks, island hopping, those types of things are occurring. It's even getting visibility into your partner networks and other people that you're connected to. We certainly heard this from our IR partners. I asked them specifically, how many times do you see an organization that's breached where the breach came from a company they're connected to? And they said all the time. And in fact, when we go to report that back to the other organization, generally we're told to drop it. And that's for negligence purposes. So I think you have an increase in the number of lawyers that are telling security programs how to run their stuff. And they're looking at it through a negligence lens, not necessarily a security lens.
That implies that our problem here is compliance, because the lawyers know that the moment it's reported, in most compliance environments, the clock starts ticking.
That's correct.
How do we move away from this, oh my God, we can't say anything because we don't want the clock starting, to actually behaving like grown-ups and just dealing with the situation?
That's a tough one. I actually think the problem's going to get worse. When you look at GDPR and this formalization of the CPO office, those are all lawyers. We're starting to see this in the States too, and it even bleeds over to your cyber insurers who are now mandating certain controls that the team has to use. I don't think that's going to get fixed anytime. I think it's going to get a little messier for the near future.
The challenge here is when I look at cyber insurance, I don't see them talking about third parties. I don't see them understanding the risk from third parties. And I certainly don't see cyber insurers going in and doing an audit in order to set a baseline before they insure a company. What do we need to do to fix that?
I think that's getting fixed. I'll speak specifically to the U.S. market because I have more experience in it. It started off when you went to apply, they just gave you an insurance policy. Fast forward a few years, then it became a form you had to fill out. And so it was like, do you have a firewall? Do you have anti-malware? Or I think they were still calling it antivirus at the time. You'd see things like unwillful omissions would mean we don't have to pay you. Meaning, I didn't mean to lie on it. I just did. Or I filled it out incorrectly. Now what you're saying is they're actually sending people on site to do assessments. So I think the UK market's just a few years behind us on that. So you start to see that. You see very large companies like Disney that are now auditing their partner companies by sending boots on the ground. Instead of filling out a bunch of paperwork that says I have all these controls, they're actually going to verify that for themselves. And I think that trend will continue as well.
You talk about companies being breached five times. If they were insured companies and this was your house being broken into five times, we all know that the insurance policy would go through the roof. Is there a risk that some companies will see having cyber insurance as no longer needing to invest so much in security because the cost is covered, whereas others will suddenly get a short, sharp wake up when their insurance policy doubles, trebles, quadruples?
Both. Speaking perfectly frankly, they'll come back and jack your prices up because it's way more risk for them to insure you. I think that will have an impact to certain organizations, especially CFOs who see that bill and go, well, wait a second, if we would have spent maybe $25,000, $50,000 on the front side of it, it would save us all this money coming out the backside. So yeah, I do see insurance playing a larger role. I think it's good. I kind of equate it to like what PCI DSS did for the credit card industry, which is set a standard of things people are supposed to do, like a responsible standard, and then ensure that people are actually doing that. I will say credit card breaches are still a thing, but they're not worth as much on the dark web. You see a lot of adversaries and criminals out there are pivoting away from it to ransom because it's got a higher ROI. So I think that'll continue.
We've seen details of these two super mega breaches that Troy Hunt revealed. What's interesting about them is you look at the number of business email addresses, and then you look at the vast number of passwords. We know credential stuffing is a significant problem. When you talk to the companies in this survey, how many of them were even aware of credential stuffing? How many of them have processes that could have prevented that?
I don't know that we asked that specific to the survey, but I'll give it to you based on my experience meeting with a lot of teams. There's two struggles right now. One struggle is the adoption of the cloud. You see a whole lot of credential harvesting happening out of Office 365 and Google and these types of environments. The visibility into that, frankly speaking, is lacking. Even the tools that are provided by the cloud manufacturers are a little lacking. I got called in to a couple of different things from some friends, and very little happened on the endpoints. A whole lot happened in the cloud, and then you started to see lateral movement there as well, out of inboxes specifically. Companies are unaware, and my largest piece of advice for anybody listening is go turn on two-factor. And yes, we can argue about whether two-factor is actually secure, or I can clone your SIM on your phone and get that done. But think about the level of sophistication it takes an actor to do that over what it takes today to credential harvest out of O365. One's trivial, one's extremely hard and would take some focus. But as an industry, we got to think about that and really make the bad guys' jobs harder because the ROI is too high right now, so they're going to keep doing it.
One thing that interested me in the report was you specifically asked about threat hunting. How many companies actively did this? What's your take on threat harvesting? And more importantly, how do companies begin to do this effectively?
I'll speak to it from this perspective. We have seen companies that say it's driven a more positive security stance. What I think happens is you have a mindset shift within the organization and within the teams. The shift is from sitting around waiting for an alert to tell you something is going on to actually being proactive with your security. That mindset starts to push its way out into all kinds of things in your program. So whether that's, I need to develop my own tools proactively, hey, I have a set of data that I don't have, and so now I have a tactical list of things to go do. You really see companies start to drive a little bit more than sort of sitting around for tech to tell them there was a problem. That's the biggest impact I see, is that the teams have put on that proactive hat. They're able to identify the areas that the adversaries are getting through and then feed that back into their prevention. And that loop becomes shorter. So instead of, hey, I'm going to wait around for a manufacturer to come up with a new product to help my prevention loop, I can do that in the meantime by threat hunting, identifying the areas of weaknesses. In a lot of cases, we see teams tuning upstream solutions like their firewall or implementing better logical segmentation as a result, being able to find the root cause. Heck, in some cases, it's tuning their spam filter a little bit more, or maybe buying some threat intelligence on email so that they know about it faster. But yeah, I think it's mostly about becoming proactive in your program and then driving change.
One of the challenges we've had with choosing tooling is, on one hand, you've got the very big security suites that come with all sorts of tools. On the other hand, we've had companies go out there and attempt to roll their own. They've chosen a bunch of best of breed, and then they've had that challenge of stitching them together. Both come with their advantages, but both come with significant flaws. You're now talking about people writing their own tools while waiting for stuff to come through. Is there not a risk that this gives them a false sense of security as opposed to a realistic security solution?
The risk is probably more continuity in your program. You'll see some of the largest organizations on the planet that have what we call Sec DevOps teams, so teams that are writing code. They're using a lot of APIs to stitch together a solution set that's actually effective. But what happens is, if I have two good Python coders and they leave, well, the entire stack that I built is probably going to fall down at some point, because they're the guys that built it and maintained it. So I think there is a risk in continuity. Certainly in either case, there's a risk of false sense of security. I go get a partner to do that, a managed security provider. I throw my problem over the fence and I assume that they're doing security things. I don't treat them like they're on my security team. I don't drive maturity in their programs or even get my team and their team together. I assume they're doing security things, but they're really not. In this particular case, when you're designing your program, you're going to have to weigh those factors in to how you're actually going to provide continuity in your program and ensure that 10 years from now, your program's still growing and maturing, rather than I solved the problem while I was in the seat for 3 years, and now it's somebody else's problem and I leave. And I see this out of CISOs all the time. they'll call like tactical CISO. So they come in post-breach, clean a bunch of stuff up, buy a bunch of new products, kludge it all together, and then 3 years later, they get hired by a bigger shop because they have that experience. You got to keep continuity in your program, so that's got to be considered.
If you're threat hunting, you require intelligence to start with. We've got multiple programs out there, some open source, some fairly closed. When you're trying to deal with those intelligent sources, it does require that you have the ability to absorb, understand, and eliminate stuff that's not relevant. How much of a challenge is that becoming? Because that intelligence data is growing faster than most organizations seem to be able to cope with it.
Yeah, 100%. I'll start with the evolution of threat intelligence, going back to IOCs. These indicators are compromised. People are running around with these huge YARA files, and they're trying to maintain all this stuff, and it gets real kludgy. By the way, IOCs are easy for an attacker to replace. As an example, if I care about domains that bad guys come from, well, they can change that on the fly. That piece of intelligence is kind of meaningless. Then you say, okay, cool, well, what's better? Oh, patterns of attack and behaviors of the adversaries are better. Awesome. Tons of work has been done in 2018 around that. So if you look at the MITRE attack framework, actually being able to put a taxonomy and nomenclature to the various TTPs that occur along the kill chain, that's been super helpful for teams. But false positive rates are an issue. I do a lot of talks on that particular topic, and what we've done is put a lot of time and effort into external threat intelligence, not enough into what I'll call normal intelligence, like, hey, this application that Microsoft wrote looks exactly like an APT. My team should know that and be able to rule that out faster or get through my false positive suppression cycle faster. So what I see a lot of teams do out there is because the intelligence is so bad, they just either ignore the alerts or they suppress them. And that becomes actually bad down the line. What they need to do is create a program for suppressions where they revisit those from time to time so that they can make sure the bad actors aren't hiding in a suppressed area.
Threat hunting teams is one thing. There's another side here, and that's the education of staff. Producing that education in such a way that people take it on board rather than you bore them stupid or you assume that once a year telling them what phishing is good enough.
Yeah, it's a struggle. I was just talking to someone about this, and there's a talk at RSA, not to plug it, but his talk, and forgive me for not remembering the name right now, but he's got 30 years of experience in just education and awareness, and so I'm very interested because I know over the course of my career, I've changed tactics and strategies a number of times. I've done everything from exactly what you said, let's create cool posters, some marketing awareness around security, all the way to trying to do some gamification around it, and I don't think anybody's nailed it. What I think back to is it's not that you're educated, it's actually that you change your behavior. I get in the behavior changing business, which is psychological, not technical. I don't know that there's enough of us with that background in the industry. I know there's a lot of folks that are coming in. I've been very encouraged by people who are coming over from that background to help us out with education awareness. But you want somebody to positively change their security behavior, to hesitate and not click a link or participate in your program and report things that they think are incidents. And that's hard. I don't know that I have a great piece of advice to give people other than what you really want to do in terms of your programs is think like a marketing person. Stop thinking like a security professional and think about how other people market their products so that people either buy them, buy into them, or buy into the brand. There's some very successful companies that have gotten people to buy into their brand. If we do a bit more of that, it will help.
That people side is important. You talked there about getting people with psychological experience to come in and understand what's going on. But we struggle to attract people. We struggle to get people from different walks of life. And without that difference in diversity of thought, we all end up in our own echo chamber. Before the podcast, we were talking about sports programs, particularly the amount of money that is sunk into bringing people through. Why are we not seeing that same effort, particularly in inner city areas, where we know a lot of these hackers are learning their first skills? Because it seems that if we invested that same amount of effort in there, we'd have a significant uptick in the pool of people we can draw on.
I often think about two things. Sports recruiting from very early ages. If you look at someone like LeBron James, he was cultivated since the time he was 12 to become an NBA player. Wouldn't that be cool to do the same thing for cyber? And, you know, certainly companies like Facebook have realized that and put in scholarship programs. So they actually identify people in middle school going into high school. I think they graduated their first person and they now work at Facebook. I believe it was someone from inner city LA. You can correct me on the comments if I'm wrong. It's interesting to me that companies are starting to solve that problem for themselves rather than relying on the education system. The other area I think about is e-gaming. If you look at the growth of e-gaming over the last 10 years, you have millions of dollars. You have professional players, most of which are very young kids. So why can't we do that for cyber? I don't know the answer to that, but I think in looking at those other areas, it gives us the ability to start to recruit and cultivate our next generation of defenders faster. And I do believe if we keep doing the same thing we've done for the last 30 years, which is, hey, the kids that are already going to school, okay, what we're actually doing is trying to talk them from going into standard STEM and just specializing in cybersecurity. Those kids were probably going to go into a STEM program anyway. What I want is more people that aren't already destined for that career path and to get them in the mix, because I think what starts to happen is it changes the mindset of everybody on those teams, changes the mindset of the community, and we're going to get better about it.
I like the mention of gaming, because if I look at some of the cybersecurity competitions around Europe, they're all using games to engage people to begin with, and then the winners of various games go on to take part in face-to-faces, with a number of them getting jobs at the end of it. But also, many of these people who are out of school, who are lost to the education and employment system, have hacked their Xbox, their PlayStation. They have those innate problem-solving skills that we struggle to teach. Do we need a better relationship, then, with the gaming companies of this world?
I think so. You know, we're trying to put together like just a gaming ISAC right now, information sharing, because TTPs inside of a game are different than they are on an endpoint. When you see terrorists that are recruiting by spraying graffiti on a wall in a game or communicating via non-standards, the mindset of a gamer lends itself directly to things like threat hunting. They're not afraid to do something for hours until they solve the problem. I had a single mom who raised us waiting tables. So you have to solve more problems when you're poor. I hate to say it like that, but it's true. So yeah, of course I can't go buy the latest game. I got to figure out how to hack it. But I'm doing it out of necessity, not out of curiosity. When you start recruiting those people, you're going to see that it directly relate to your programs, especially if they're going into the offensive side.
It's an interesting challenge though for employers, isn't it? I spoke to a couple last year, and both of them took the view of we'd have to think about our existing employees. How would we get them to sit down with people who they learnt had maybe got a criminal record or weren't perhaps as educated or came from the wrong part of town? We talk so much about diversity, yet we still have these old snobbish Victorian attitudes in many ways.
The same thing in the States, maybe a little different. Some of the older folks in InfoSec clearly did some jail time and they're out with companies and have been giving back. At CB Connect last year, Carbon Black Connect, our big conference, we had Frank Abagnale speak, author of Catch Me If You Can, Spielberg movie. Very fascinating to sit down and talk to someone who broke lots of laws, lots of crime. But when you look at what he's given back to the community, you could clearly say Frank is responsible for most of the anti-check fraud that we have today, for a lot of the electronic fraud detection that we have today, and he's helped drive that with law enforcement. So I think maybe in the States it's a little different for us because we're sort of used to criminals maybe jumping in on the problem and helping out. But as I say, I would like to talk to a home thief about securing my house because they probably know how to bypass all the controls that are on it. We do have to put that mindset down and look, I'm not encouraging people to go become criminals, but I look at everything as a learning opportunity. What can I learn? What can I apply to my program? And if I'm not talking to everybody, that's actually doing a disservice to the program and to goals I want to accomplish.
It's interesting because it comes back to cost, doesn't it? I noticed in the report you were talking about there's been some cost uplift, but the problem is the board is fed up of pouring money into cybersecurity. It's a bottomless pit. It doesn't see anything back. It sees salary rates going up ridiculously. If you've got 2 to 3 years experience and you're not on six figures, you've got to ask yourself what you're doing wrong. But if we can recruit from what is effectively a socioeconomic underclass, then we can bring people in earlier. We don't have to wait for them to finish a degree where they join us with tens of thousands of pounds worth of debt that they have to be able to service. What is it we just need to do to push companies to get involved here?
I think about a couple of things on this journey. One is the IT evolution we've gone through. You used to have few people with high skills. I take cold fusion programmers as one of the examples. Cold fusion programmers were getting paid back in the day. I certainly went down a career path of being a Unix admin. I was qualified on all the Solaris platforms because that's where the money was at the time. I think about those things and then I go, well, yeah, but now a Red Hat engineer is kind of, it's a standard pay scale. Cold fusion's actually gone. Hopefully some of those programmers picked up some new skills. As specialization gets out into the hands of the many and it becomes generalized, you can start to drive down the salary costs there. If you fast forward, we're going through essentially what IT went through with few people that have the skills, and that'll start to balance out. The other thing I think about is countries like India, countries like Brazil. Brazil put these awesome programs in place to get these kids in that could code. One of the mistakes they made is they didn't have a place to land them in jobs. So they all went into the dark side and started teaching everybody how to ransom all the things. But then you think about a country like India that has essentially lifted the country out of poverty through coding. and through IT skills. I think about those things and I go, we have plenty of jobs to land people in. So I'm not worried that if I train people in offensive skills, a large percentage are going to go into the criminal market. In fact, I would tell you most of us just want a paycheck and a mortgage and all those good things. These programs that companies like Facebook are putting together where they're essentially paying for their schools so that they can get in and be effective and get a job, I think are great. But we really need more public-private partnership on that. That needs to become a thing, and it can't just be a thing in the San Diego market or the New York market. It's got to be a thing globally, and we need to do a better job at it. So, yeah, we got to put some work in on that.
Those red skill teams these people have, when we look at the report and we look at people being breached, they're getting pretty essential, aren't they? Because if you're a large organization and you don't attack yourself regularly, you don't know where it's coming from. When you run reports like this and when you talk to customers, how many of them now are realizing that red skill teams are just as important as a DBA or a network admin?
If you took the largest organizations on the planet, it doesn't matter what country, they've realized that. And so you'll see full red teams and full blue teams. So offensive hackers versus their SOC and blue teams. What they're doing, and I credit Chris Nickerson on this particular one, is their purple team. Chris talked about this a long time ago. It's like, hey, you can't just have your red team come in and deliver a PDF report, because that PDF report sits on a shelf. And at the end of that year, you probably get one of those things done. You got to go through change management and quality control and all these things. Whereas if you can get a little more proactive and a little more agile in your programs, you can have your red and blue teams get together and drive change faster. So the blue team's got to understand what the adversary's doing. And for the red teams, you got to get more creative. You're constantly shrinking your attack surface. You're constantly building better detectors for what the bad guys are doing. Your blue team is picking up red team skills along the way. Your red team is actually starting to think like defenders. So it's not just about breaking things. It's also producing a result, which is how do we remediate the thing? And in some cases, maybe that's I have to sit down with a programmer and teach them how to do it. Or let's do a live coding session where we attack it at the same time you're coding it, which is all great. But again, going back to proactivity, it just allows those prevention cycles to get faster. If you get attacked by, you can't wait months. Especially now that we have breach notifications, if you're still waiting around to plug that hole, you have 30 days to announce it to the whole world, even the bad guys. And then it's like, how long do you think it's going to figure out another bad actor group that Apache Stretch is vulnerable? Like, that's not going to take very long. So you got to get that cycle down to a reasonable amount.
So if I was to say, what are the four big lessons out of this report that companies take on board? What are they?
Yeah, well, number one, it's going to take an investment in your program. When you think about cybersecurity, you got to really think about its brand protection these days. And so typically brand stuff is driven out of marketing dollars. I'm not saying marketing is not important, but at some point the leadership of a company needs to put that together and say, you can't just market the thing without protecting the thing. So maybe there's some dollars that can be shared amongst that. I think two, proactive is better than reactive. It's a number two takeaway. If you put yourself on a proactive footing, even if you just start threat hunting small, I'll see a lot of companies do this. I can't go threat hunt 24/7. Okay, well, cool. Can you allocate like 5% of one staff members to go look at high-risk systems? And the example I use is, well, I know my CEO is going to China. I kind of know the things about China. When he comes back with his laptop, maybe I'm just going to hunt on that laptop, right? I don't have to boil the ocean. I don't have to go to all the things. The next takeaway is don't wait around to get attacked again. Really listen to the professionals that come and clean it up and drive some sort of change in your program. Number four, I would say the more you educate users in your environment, the less issues you're going to have. It can't all be about hitting users over the head when they click on a link. We should go in knowing that users are going to click on a link and create some tech to help them with that. But what I like to tell people about that is partner with your team. So instead of yelling at someone when they make a mistake, use it as an educational opportunity. Yes, it's frustrating because we have to deal with the pain when someone clicks on a thing. But I think if you start to partner with them and you sit down and as a team, as their department, use it not like a name and shame sort of way, but more as a positive learning experience so that everybody gets better, you're going to be better off.
Rick, thank you for your time.
Yeah, thank you.